Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. This week again, we go off the beaten path to look at another adjacent thing that is very important when talking about the Coppola family, the new book by Ian Nathan, The Coppolas, A Movie Dynasty. This is a fantastic chat. I was lucky enough to get a preview copy of Ian's fantastic book, which is out now in all good and bad bookshops. Be sure to buy one from the good ones. It's a fantastic read. And hopefully listening to this conversation, you'll get a lot more of an insight and kind of the wealth of knowledge that Ian has. He's the man to go to. If you know Ian's work, or if you don't, he's written books and all manner of things to do with film, whether it's Ridley Scott, Alien, Tarantino, Wes Anderson, Guillermo del Toro, the Coen brothers. He's got all bases covered, and he's a fantastic writer, and he's a fantastic guest as well. I felt like I could have talked to Ian for many more hours, and I'm sure if he'll come back, I'll have him back on at some point, maybe to discuss a film, maybe to discuss another book, if there is, we can find some link to the Coppola family in some way. So all that's left to do is to head to the Napa Valley, make sure that the white wine is cold and the red wine is room temperature. Make sure that you've got a nice pot of bolognese sauce on the boil, ready for the family to enjoy. And have a conversation about the greatest film family of all time as we make some Coppola connections. As a fledgling Coppola scholar, I'm thrilled today to be joined by The Real Thing, a man who has quite literally written a book on that subject. As this podcast argues, the greatest film family of all time. It's, of course, journalist, documentary talking head, blogger, and writer of many books, including aforementioned The Coppolas, A Movie Dynasty. Ian Nathan, how are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. It's very nice to be talking about the book. Now it's out, so it's quite exciting. I mean, you live in your head for a long time when you write a book, and you've got no outside force to kind of interact with, and sort of the relatives you bore. So it's a great release when the book finally comes out, and you get to talk about it, and it becomes more real in a strange way once you're live, and it's kind of speaking to people who actually read it.
One of the things, like, I guess I really wanted to know, like, especially when it came to writing a book about the Coppola family, is, like, with a wealth of kind of stories and almost like books out there, was it a daunting prospect to kind of tackle as somebody who kind of almost have a collection, whether it's like Michael Schumacher or Peter Cowie books that are kind of like dedicated to certain films. Was it ever daunting to you to kind of like tackle that subject as well?
Absolutely. The first place you get to is daunting. It's and especially it's on a subject as big as Coppola, that you're almost dissuaded from your path. You know, it's like great minds have been there, great writers have been there. You know, Coppola himself is a wonderful sort of self-biographer. Every interview he's ever given and documentaries and all the kind of the stuff that's out there sort of makes you fear. And you think, I'm just going to be treading in other people's footsteps. I'm going to be telling the same old stories. And you have to kind of get beyond that and use sort of certain kind of frames of mind to do it. One of them is that, you know, no one has read me on the Coppolas,
yes.
You know, for good or bad. This is my take on them. There hasn't been a fresh book on them outside of sort of academic circles. I believe you may know better, but I believe for a number of years now. So it was a chance to bring them up to date and look back on the many great films from today, from 2021 and the world we're now in and the movie world we're now in. So that kind of gave me some freedom. And working with the publisher, and they should take some credit, they were much more a driving force behind doing The Family and very much doing Sophia alongside Francis and looking at them from the idea of fathers and daughters and generations. And as you said, it's incredible filmmaking family and trying to give it a theme. And the theme, it's a very obvious one if you think about the Coppolas, is family.
Yeah.
And he's made films about it. It's been the driving force of his life. And it's very much the driving force of Sophia's life and career as well. So I think, hopefully, I've kind of come at it with a slightly unusual approach and sense of trying to interpret the life and films through that idea of family and connection and, you know, where it's taken them.
How did you go about kind of like narrowing it down? Because as somebody who like has kind of started a podcast looking at the entire Coppola family, like, and like the start of your book has the family tree, and it's almost like looking at it is again a daunting prospect, because you start going, right, so you've got Talia Shire, you've got Nicolas Cage, you've got, like, however you want to look at it, you've got Jack Schwartzman, you've got Jonathan Schwartzman, like, was it a thing of like, I really need to keep it focused to this kind of core group and not kind of look to all them peripheries?
Well, what some of it's practical. You are given a certain amount of latitude by a publisher, but they're not going to give you endless pages and endless words. You know, there are limits to what you can write, so you have to be disciplined at level. And in a sense, that discipline then shapes your writing and your approach. I kind of knew from the outset, simply because I was really into them both, that I wanted Francis and Sophia to be the backbone of the story, because that's where the films lie. That's, you know, they are directors. In a sense, I'm better at writing about directors than I am actors and other kind of artists. And then I thought, you know, in my head at the beginning, I was going to do lots of stuff on the family, huge amounts, sprawling saga. But it became quite quickly apparent that if you're going to write the story of The Godfather and tell Nicolas Cage's life story, you need about four different books at work. You know, as you say, it's really hard. So I had to kind of program the book along certain lines, define it. And then once you were telling the stories, those other characters, the other family members, sort of almost naturally folded into the main story. So Talia is obviously there a little bit at the beginning because she's his sister and she's in the family. But she really comes into the book in terms of The Godfather and, you know, trying to get into her brother's film when he didn't want her in it and all those stories. So that's in it, the ideal place to introduce her. Then obviously Nicolas Cage comes into it with The Cotton Club and the point he sort of joins the circus and his relation. And then, you know, Jason Schwartzman, you know, those later on with Sophia's work. So it sort of was a natural way of doing it in the end that I would concentrate on Francis and Sophia. They were my story, but you would feed off. And hopefully you kind of keyed into this a little bit. There's actually the other main character in the book is Eleanor.
Yes.
Although she's kind of a ghost in a way, because it doesn't sort of tackle her head on. for me, she's almost the hero of the story.
Yeah.
Because I think she has done more than anyone and endured more than anyone to hold it all together and to keep the engine going and to deal with Frances, which alone is a lifetime's work. But also she's her own person and her own artist and has been frustrated, I think, along the way and fought against it. And I found her stories very moving.
Yeah.
And she's, again, we talk about sources and books out there. Mm-hmm. Her diaries are probably the best biographies there are on both Sophia and Frances. She's a wonderful writer and really precise and detailed. So I loved all that.
It's always beautiful to see as well that Eleanor would have like shot a lot of like behind the scenes like features for a lot of like, even if it's like Sophia's, I think it's Marie Antoinette, like she's got a kind of like documentary that runs alongside it. And it always comes back to that thing you said, it comes back to family. And I think that is like the perfect angle to take on a book about, I always make the joke on the podcast that it's basically like this crime family. Like, it is this kind of thing of like, and you do have that like Michael Corleone moment almost of Francis handing over the baton of the kind of like the family dynasty to Sophia in the late 90s. And I think there's that amazing clip at the Oscars, I think, when she won for Lost in Translation. You kind of see the ecstatic joy on his face of like how he was just bowled over. And like one of the things I wanted to kind of get your opinion on is obviously is the idea of nepotism in the Coppola family. Are you one to believe that it is like this dirty thing, or is it that kind of, I don't know, like almost you just want to see your children and your family succeed?
It's an interesting point. I kind of saw it, as you say, it's a little bit like they are a crime family and this is the family business.
Yeah.
And it's almost like she had to become a director. She had no other choice. She was brought into the family business. That's what you did. And that's what Roman has done. And you can't escape it. Also, I think art runs in genes. I think the talent, Carmine was very talented and back and, the grandfathers were very talented, Francis' grandfather. And that came down into Sophia and Roman, extraordinarily talented, and talent will out, it has to get out and do it. I think obviously having Francis Ford Coppola as your father is a good thing if you want to get into the film industry. It's helpful, and his name and Zoetrope produced her films, produced Roman's films, and have helped with Eleanor as well. So yes, that's certainly true, but I think nepotism sells it all short. I think it's almost like an instinct that they kind of had to do this. And, family is so important to Francis that even the shooting of the films were kind of family enterprises. He brought in the children at a very early age. They were running about the sets as toddlers, almost. And literally, almost, they were kind of running about the sets. Godfather Part Two, there's young Sophia scampering around.
Yeah.
So, it's a world you can't even escape from. What would be more surprising, I think, if Sophia had gone off to become a physicist or a doctor and did that, we were going, what the hell's going on? And she's so different. And this was very clear in doing the book. She's so much her own person. Mm-hmm. And she escaped the daddy's girl thing very quickly. So I think she could see it ahead of anyone. She worried about it. And I think she almost was put off. But the fact everyone would call her, your daddy's girl, it's the only way you got to pick up a camera. And actually, very quickly, Virgin Suicides into Lost in Translation. We forgot. Yeah. We kind of went, she's her own filmmaker and she's doing her own thing. And a very different kind of filmmaker too.
How would you like kind of describe those differences? Because there is that core like thing that you mentioned. Again, and it comes back to family, that they both have these and somewhat like whether it's that story that Gene Hackman's character has in The Conversation about being a sickly child is like lifted straight from Francis's life, and then you look at Sophia's films and they all just feel autobiographical about what they've kind of been through. But where do you see like that kind of, I don't know, the differences in what they do, like, and again, both amazing at kind of adapting books or kind of other works.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right on that level that the main subject in both their films is themselves.
Yeah.
to a degree. They kind of, and I think Francis especially would say that is as it should be. Every artist gives of himself yeah. to the work. And, you know, incredible, you know, historical thing that he didn't want to make The Godfather, that he resisted it and hated it, when it's absolutely an outpouring of his own heritage and ideas and textures and everything about it speaks of Francis Coppola, that you think, okay, how did that happen? But that kind of shows you what an artist he is. With Sophia, certainly, I think she's in a way even more personal, a filmmaker. She's even more sort of identified with her characters. And, you know, she, you know, Lost in Translation is a very autobiographical film. This is the version Suicide. As to an extent, is Marie Antoinette. I think all of her, certainly her first phase of films are about hotels, living in hotels, which obviously she did for a lot of her life, and the world she lived in, which was both privileged and very lonely. And I think that comes out. I think also, and I hope this comes across in the book, I think a lot of her characters are based on her mother and her mother's loneliness. I think the Scarlett Johansson character in Lost in Translation is both Sophia and it's her mother to a degree. You know, things that maybe she was not conscious of. You know, all artists are subconscious on many levels. Where they differ, Francis and Sophia, is obviously male and female comes into it. There is a male tendency in Francis' work. There aren't many female lead characters in his films. Peggy Sue got married and a few others, but he's a male-dominated world, and Sophia is the opposite. Also, she likes harmony in terms of the textures and also in terms of how the films are made. There's no one shoots action on a Sophia Coppola film. That's too loud. Yeah, they just get going. So the only you can only shout if it's required by the script. No one else is going to raise their voice. It's going to be a harmonious world. Whereas Francis, it's just, you know, if he's not making a film in a literal storm, he's got to make a film in a kind of self-induced storm.
Yeah.
And the chaos creates the art and it sort of feeds into it. So Apocalypse Now, you know, became a masterpiece because it was this kind of Vietnam to make. And he self-generated a lot of that.
Even onto like One from the Heart, where it's like he had this opportunity to make this small contained thing. It still came like spiraled out of control and became this like ridiculous thing where he's making the Las Vegas Strip on a soundstage at Zoetrope Studios. And like, I find all of that like fascinating, this kind of like he feels like a director who needs to be like all chips on the table. We could like go in for broke, otherwise it's not going to happen. And recently we've just had the news that what he's self-financing his kind of passion project that he's had for like the last however many years, and it's like he's still got that spark in him at the age of like 82.
Yeah, he's marvellous, just in terms of, you know, a director. He's a marvellous director, and he's a marvellous character, and he's a marvellous subject to write about, because he is, you know, he is the fury of the artist out there, but he's the Italian man who wears his heart on his sleeve and is all passion. So in a way, you know, his thought is incredibly different from him. And yeah, he'll go into any project probably with the ideal of doing something small and contained, and the passion wells up and the opportunity wells up, and the gambler in him wells up. That if he's not taking the biggest risks on the biggest stage, he's not himself. There are great sort of historical stories of him and George Lucas, you know, couldn't be more opposed, yet became great friends. Yeah. And Lucas, it's like control, discipline, you know, store the money, you know, small increments, do things that are commercially sensible. Francis is just charge ahead. Let's do it. Let's spend money we haven't got. Let's risk the whole family enterprise, risk the kind of the houses and the business to create the art. And it's a kind of romance in that. And as you say, 82 years old, he's still doing it. Megalopolis, he's going to put everything on the line to make it, like, vineyards. And I'm sure Eleanor is like saying, excuse me, Francis, are you sure about this? But it's wonderful. And I hope, from what I understand, it's a huge idea about building the utopian society and the forces against that. And he wants to build his own version of New York using CGI. So, I mean, I do hope he gets to do it. And, it's, you know, it sounds incredible. But it's also that kind of thing, when the one he'll never get to make. It's also a romantic idea. He's got a project that's always just ahead of him.
It almost feels like he's got that same spirit of packing his family up in a car and driving across, like, America to make The Rain People, right? Like, it's still, like, no matter how famous and, like the kind of accolades he's got, that, like, yeah, he's got that spirit in him is a beautiful thing to behold. So I wanted to, like, rewind a bit and where did the kind of germ of the idea of this book come from? Like, what made you tackle it?
It's several things come together, different ideas. One was, obviously, I got into writing books, having been an empire, and I moved into being a film author, and sort of staked out a territory of doing directors. As I said earlier, I find them easier to write about. The marriage of sort of the technical side with the artistic side, and some, you know, and the personal side as well, just seemed to appeal to me. And I don't, you know, and a certain amount of it comes from practical decisions. You know, your publisher talks to you about potential subjects into the future, and they will know things about the marketplace as well. So they will come and say, well, X or Y will sell very well in Spain and France. You know, foreign sales are important. You know, there's kind of like a boring kind of company element to it, finances. So that was part of it as well. Really, I think I got very engaged with the idea once we started talking about doing Sophia and Francis together. Like you said at the beginning, doing Francis alone worried me. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, this is a guy who's, you know, there are some brilliant biographies out there. You know, I'd read them and I thought, how can I better them? And I didn't want to do a kind of definitive Francis biography book because, you know, that's years in the making and all those things. And there's a kind of wariness about him, how much you involve him and his estate and clearances. So once we got this idea of putting Sophia and Francis together and doing the family, it made sense to me. And that's when I got excited. And that's when, you know, what you do is then you put proposals together and have a chapter breakdown and you write a couple of chapters. I think my samples were on a bit of Apocalypse Now, and I did a bit of Lost in Translation. I could show them both. Yeah. And of course, they change completely once you get your samples are completely transformed when you're writing it. And what was a very interesting thing with this book, as opposed to any other book I've written, is that very early on, I got a voice for it. Mm-hmm. And it was a slightly more novelistic voice than perhaps the stuff I'd written in the past. It was very much a story.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. And that came from the couplets. That came from the inside outwards. That once you wrote about this passionate Italian family, you had to apply a kind of passionate pace to it.
Yes.
You had to, you know, give it this sort of sense of a world unfolding as quick as it can possibly unfold. And that was very freeing. Once I kind of got that voice, I kind of knew how to write the book, for good or bad. You know, you had to then keep it going. You know, the difficulty with Francis is once you've done kind of everything up to Rumblefish, they're all fantastic stories. You kind of get into, you know, obviously Cotton Club is a great story and Peggy Sue, but once you're in Jack and things, you're like, how do you keep this all going? And, you know, when he's just mainly doing things for the money. But in the end, it wasn't a problem. Because I had this tone of voice, because I had Eleanor and all these other subjects as part of it, it seemed to come quite easily.
And I guess, like, the thing that your book is fortunate about is, like, obviously doing just a biography on Francis Ford Coppola, like, going through that career, it can somewhat end on a whimper. Do you know what I mean? To kind of go from, like, somebody who kind of came out the gate. And even, like, later on, there are still interesting stories. Like, we've kind of touched on One from the Heart. That kind of saga feels like it's, again, is something that could be a book all to itself. Like, that kind of idea of he finally made the studio and then kind of gambled it all on this one film. And then I think it was Boyd Hilton, when he was on this podcast, said, like, it feels like Francis Ford Coppola never really recovered from that period of his life, like creatively or kind of personally to some degree, of just, like, kind of, you know, achieving the dream and then losing it all so quickly. So what does the research for a book like this look like for you?
It looks quite dull because actually it's a lot of reading. And obviously I was writing during a pandemic. So I couldn't get to some of the libraries that I've used in the past. There's libraries in California and other places. So that was all kind of a little bit off the table. And actually, thankfully, a lot of the places I do use and have used in the past and different things had opened up a kind of an online facility.
Amazing.
To sort of get around the pandemic problems. And there are fantastic libraries of sort of newspaper cuttings. So once you've sort of done the Schumachers and the Cowies, and you've read all those books, once you've read Eleanor's diaries, and that became a very important resource. Obviously, you watch all the films again. Then you kind of go into the newspaper articles and the reviews and the things for the time. And there's a kind of, a sort of way you sort of, everything expands outwards. So you read one interview and it suggests another interview.
Yeah.
And you get sort of weird tangential things that bring riches that you hadn't expected. And that's one of the challenges. When you come to subjects like The Godfather or Apocalypse Now, and even Lost in Translation, Marie Antoinette, there's so much being written, and terrific things written and very detailed things written. So you're looking for the tangential element to throw in, to sort of throw it open and to bring different. So I read Sam Wasson's book on the making of Chinatown. Amazing. And that's got a lot of fantastic things in it about that time and Robert Evans and Paramount that I could then sort of tuck back into the Coppola side of things. So Evans became a very important character in the book too. And then through that emerged an idea of, subtextually almost, that it's a Hollywood story. Mm-hmm. And what you hopefully see is how Hollywood changes. It goes obviously from the great sort of movie brat era and all that kind of chaos into the 80s and 90s where the studios reasserted themselves and it was the era of the blockbuster and Francis was almost sort of alien to all that. Then into the kind of the early 90s, into the 2000s with the indie scene and the new generation of filmmakers, of which Sophia was part and parcel. So and right at the end, although it's only just sort of starting, streaming sort of happens. On the Rocks was an Apple film. And that money was just sort of changing. And you see what Roman is doing. There's kind of a move into a different kind of thing. So it was almost a subtext, but I read quite a lot on just Hollywood history through those times. And then you pick up where Lucas was and how Finian's Rainbow was made and all that kind of backstory, and learned so much I wasn't aware of.
Yeah. I always like to look when like it's somebody's birthday to see if there is, obviously the podcast is Coppola Connection. So like, is there a connection to that person? Just so I can like, I don't know, wheel out for happy birthday to Jack Nicholson. And I think like on that, I found out that like Francis Ford Coppola had done uncredited rewrites on like a Roger Corman film that stars Jack Nicholson or something like that.
He did. He finished it for Corman. Yeah. Corman had a habit of starting a film, getting it all going, shooting three quarters of it, then going off and starting the next one, with the next lump of money. And then would leave his sort of second AD behind to finish it. And that was Coppola on I can't remember the name of it, but I think it was Jack Nicholson in the Pacific Surf. They're shooting up a Big Sur. And Nicholson tells his story, it's in the book, about the fact that he felt he was being drowned by Coppola as he kept throwing him back in for another take. It's a Roger Corman film. And he was in this full regalia with a kind of saber and all this kind of stuff. And Coppola just goes, he's just grouching. He's just being a kind of an old moaner. It was, no one was at risk. But they did. They did make a film together. And there were times. I mean, Nicholson was one of the people who were in the frame for The Godfather. A bit of Michael Corleone, maybe. The thinking seemed to be it was more likely Tom Hagen at one point.
Yeah.
That Nicholson. I think he read for it. I don't think it's a case of he nearly got it. I think there were a lot of people reading. And, a lot of names in the hat at that point. But he does circle the world, Nicholson. So, you're absolutely. I mean, Coppola is so present in film from about 1968, really, to the end of the 90s. Maybe kind of a bit earlier than that, he sort of becomes a bit more of an elder statesman. But he's connected with everything that was going on. Spielberg, Lucas, all of that.
Yeah.
And Star Wars. I mean, he's intimately connected with the creation of Star Wars.
Yeah. So I always pose this question to a lot of my guests on the podcast when we deep dive into a film, and it's a really throwaway, like, kind of silly question, but it is that thing of, like, if they had to pick someone from the Coppola family to kind of, like, keep their filmography and get rid of it, and then, like, it always get rid of the rest of the family's filmographies. It always kind of, like, so many times I've had that conversation about the Francis Ford Coppola almost being this, like, nexus point of cinema. And, like, if you kind of take him out of cinema history, you don't get Star Wars, perhaps, because it's kind of like, there's that great story of how I think it was, like, George Lucas won a competition, right, at UCLA to go on set at Warner Brothers. And that's, like, Francis Ford Coppola was like, here's another guy who's under the age of 50 on set. Who's bearded. I like the look of him. Like, come and join me. Do you want to, like, join this kind of ragtag band of people? Like, I've stolen a load of film. We're going to shoot this movie across America. Do you want to do a documentary? I'll find out a way for you to get paid. And, like, that is the birth of George Lucas as a filmmaker right then, right?
Absolutely. And without Coppola being the driving force in all of that, none of that really happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I think certain things would have happened. Friedkin and those guys were all operating a bit separately. Mm-hmm. I mean, in true terms, Coppola isn't a movie brat because he's first generation. The movie brats came in with a sort of second wave, and Coppola was first. He was already working in the studios. As you say, he was on Finian's Rainbow when Lucas walked in and watched him at work, the Fred Astaire musical. And Hanke's so key. I mean, he's the catalyst in all of that. And if you take him out, then I don't think you even get Spielberg or Scorsese to the same level. Mm-hmm. Maybe they would have happened. But he was such a driving force in wanting to change things. And The Godfather was so important in terms of, it was a commercial success. If it had been a flop, you don't get the movie brats. You don't get the auteur era. Yeah. It would have folded.
Yeah.
Because The Godfather was a hit, and all the studios went, we need some of that. We've got to bring in these talented young guys to create films like The Godfather. And The Exorcist as well, to a certain extent. But it was absolutely The Godfather that drove that. Mm. And it was, of course, George Lucas who forced Coppola to take The Godfather. Because he didn't want to do it. He was just like, I'm an artist. I want to make personal films about my life. And there's Lucas going, they're locking in the gates of the company. The bailiffs are coming. You've got to take the job, Francis.
Yeah, because it's like ill-fated. Is it like the director's company that was supposed to be Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, William Friedkin, and Peter Bogdanovich?
It's the director's company comes slightly afterwards. That was a product of The Godfather and the Starz film. That was Friedkin, Bogdanovich, and Coppola, and it was a kind of Paramount idea. Who were thinking, well, if we're going to have auteurs doing it, let's have our own little stable of auteurs. We'll give them a load of money and they'll hopefully come back with, you know, these kind of independent style films that would become great hits. Because all these companies that they formed were a disaster because they're all egotists and filmmakers and artists at odds with each other. So the original Zoetrope, which is a fabulous story, there's almost like a novel to be written about that first era at Zoetrope in San Francisco. There's a wonderful documentary.
I've probably seen it.
Really good documentary about the craziness of what they were doing. You know, people were sleeping under the desks because they were homeless and all these kind of mad things.
I love that the focal point of that is that they had a cappuccino machine. That was kind of the most like state of the art thing that they had, and kind of like put them head and shoulders above every other studio. It was like, they're making cappuccinos over at Zoetrope.
Yeah, they saw the future. They were into coffee. It's kind of wonderful, but it's chaos because, in the end, you've got the inmates running the asylum. And they're all kind of wanting to pursue their wonderful visionary projects, but no one wants to run the accounting department. No one wants to run the kind of thing like a studio. And that's why the studios reasserted themselves, because they had the business acumen. They needed the money, these guys. Yeah. They had all the ideas, but they had no money because Francis kept spending it on cappuccino makers and editing suites and swimming pools and all sorts of nonsense. But, without that, though, what was wonderful about that whole era and his story is the mix. It's, you get that incredible auteur spirit and drive and passion mixed with these vulnerable studios who needed content and work and needed something to kind of happen. And because they came together, then you got The Godfather, you know, right through to Apocalypse Now and Heaven's Gate when it all kind of collapsed.
What is some of the like more kind of off the beat, not necessarily like the highlights of the book, but like the stories that you like kind of go like, I'm proud I kind of eked that out, like stuff that like really excited you when you came across it.
One of the things, as I mentioned earlier, was definitely Eleanor's story and trying to pull that out and to keep her present. Because the more I read of her and the more I kind of read about her, I got very sympathetic to her and I thought she was very important. She wasn't just the mother and the wife. Mm-hmm. She is a guiding artistic spirit. I loved, and it really gave it a godfathery feel, was going backwards and finding who the grandfathers were and the stories of immigrants coming in, which obviously are replayed in the films. You know, the Ellis Island sequence in Godfather Part 2 is a homage to Coppola's own grandfathers, both who came in from Italy. Mm. So that connection was wonderful. Obviously, one of the central threads of my reasoning was, I think, the defining event in his life is the polio and being basically bedbound for a year. And that's when he becomes, you know, the director to come. I think that was fantastic. Then he's just getting into sort of down the line, because once you sort of get past doing The Godfather and doing The Conversation, Godfather Part 2 and Apocalypse Now, and trying your best to bring freshness and vigor to those stories, which are very well told, and coming at it with kind of an excitement. It was then looking at the later films and sort of trying to understand him in the prism of those films. I very much enjoyed writing about Peggy Sue Got Married, mm-hmm. which I think is a really great film and a really different film from him. And then, he sort of denies it a bit. He says it was just a studio job, but it really is one of his films because, you know, it's about an era, and I think that's his era, and he's sort of doing a different thing about history and memory and all those things.
I love that it's his one of, like, the, you know, like a lot of those directors, like a lot of the 80s directors were doing their 50s film, whether it's like Bob Zemeckis with like the Back to the Future and stuff like that. And like, I love that Francis is a bit weird and he let Nicolas Cage do that voice for one. Like, do you know what I mean? It is this time travel, like, almost it feels almost like a kind of 60s, like 50s film, like an old like Disney film, somewhat like a kind of Freaky Friday style stuff. I love Peggy. I've got a real soft spot for 80s Coppola. I'm kind of like The Outsiders and Rumblefish, I think, are like fantastic and stuff like that. But I think that stuff's just as interesting. And like you were saying, with kind of being worried to write about like that chunk of the 70s stuff, like as a podcaster, I get that daunting feeling, and it's the reason I've kind of put off covering Apocalypse Now. Yeah, that run of films is the thing that, what can be said that hasn't already been said? Yeah. Basically, is that's why I'm more excited. Like, let's talk about One from the Heart. Like, nobody really talks about that film. Like, and it's probably like just as interesting a story as Apocalypse Now. And like, it's instead of, I don't know, kind of being out in the wilderness and going mad, it's then becoming almost this agoraphobic, maniacal man in a trailer trying to direct a film like that. And it's like that hangover from making Apocalypse Now made him go the complete opposite way.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, he went from the outdoors film to the completely indoors film. I don't think anyone can miss that. I love there's a great, I'm not trying to teach you to sort of suck eggs, but there's a great story in pre-Godfather Coppola. The story from Corman through to Rain People. It's a wonderful, and he'd done so much.
Yeah.
We didn't think kind of he was almost invented with The Godfather. And I suppose on a larger scale, he was. But actually, he'd won an Oscar already for for the, you know, the screenplay for Patton. He'd just been given this job. You know, he wasn't an expert on Patton. He was just thought, because he'd written on Paris is Burning and gone to Paris for his terrible bloated film. I even had to watch that. I wouldn't recommend that highly. I mean, he's only one of the screenwriters. It's a great bloated thing. Got some good bits in it, but it's not a great movie. But he'd been sitting in Paris writing this terrible kind of Hollywood historical drama. And he came back. And, you know, studios are so short-sighted. They, you know, they look at his CV and go, oh, he writes about military stuff, army history. Do you want to write Patton? So he gets given, he goes, no, I don't want to write Patton. They go, here's $50,000. He goes, okay, I'll write about Patton. And, of course, he does a brilliant job with Patton. He brings on these kind of meta ideas about the hawkish general, you know, that wonderful opening of the film with George C. Scott kind of just talking to the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all Coppola. It's all him that sort of comes up with that. And I kind of really enjoyed that sort of stage of the career where he's sort of, you know, you're a big boy now. You know, it's such a exciting film. It's like a French New Wave film. Mm-hmm. And he's just out there. And there were so many things about that I didn't realize. They were just kind of on the loose in New York shooting it.
Yeah.
And there's the whole sequence in a department store. And one of the things I said, they had no permission apart from they had to shoot at lunchtime. But they were going to keep the customers in. They weren't going to tell the customers. So all the cameras were in carrier bags and things.
Amazing.
And because they were doing a chase sequence, like running downstairs, they kept bustling into kind of poor old customers, this New York department store. And apparently a fight broke out with the lead actor. And they kind of like, he had to fight back. They're just shooting. I'm sure Coppola loved all that, you know, all that kind of freshness and vibrancy. But I think that really kind of intrigued me that, you know, it's like you have to do the big elements. You can't avoid them.
Yes.
You've got to kind of knock the barnacles off those stories and go into The Godfather and just tell it. But it's a chance to sort of tell the other side of the story and to tell people what, you know, how we got to The Godfather, you know, what had already happened, what he already knew, what was already driving him, I think is really important. And it was really kind of exciting because you sort of find out who he is far more, I think, through the past.
Yeah. And he always suffers from that, like, Kubrick thing when people like don't take in the thing that like you said, like Kubrick is known for the Warner Brothers years, and it's kind of anything pre that, it's like, oh, what are they? Well, Paths of Glory, like what's that? Like even like Spartacus, do you know what I mean? It's almost like it's not seen as a film de Kubrick. It's kind of like I think Francis Ford Coppola in that era. And is it You're a Big Boy Now? Is it Roman Coppola who plays the baby in like some of those scenes as well? I vaguely remember reading that somewhere. Or
I think it must be Gio, the oldest one who died because of the ages they are. Because I think Roman is born in Paris.
Yes.
When he was writing Paris is Burning. So Roman was, and there's always been something very European about Roman, the films he makes and the kind of person he is and hanging out with Wes Anderson and doing their quirky films. I always think the fact that he was born in Paris had sort of a strange influence on the kind of the, you know, artist he became.
Well, one of the things I love about like looking through like the other books you've written is there is this kind of like, it's almost, and it kind of, it tickles me that like, no matter who you've kind of written about, there is always these kind of connections to the Coppola with a lot of them, whether it is Wes Anderson. And like, I think Roman Coppola is like a big part of like, of what Wes Anderson does. And obviously like his second film is the breakout film for Jason Schwartzman. It's like one of the most like personal and like moving films of his career is co-written by Roman Coppola. And like, it's done a lot of like second AD stuff, whether it's The Life Aquatic, Steve Zissou, or yeah, all you've got to do is look at The Darjeeling Limited and realize that Adrian Brody's character is basically playing an avatar for Roman. And it's almost like when you look at the Coppola family, it's there's a lot of like three siblings a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it kind of like, you can see that thing of that story is siblings wanting to live up to the memory of their father, in this case like dead, but like you can imagine like Roman and Sophia definitely probably having conversations, and even Jason Schwartzman to some degree like, we're trying to make our way in this kind of acting and movie biz, and we got that hulking giant like looming above us.
I think I'm sure there's like a university sort of exam question you could set in film studies about, you know, how much is Bill Murray an avatar of Francis Coppola in the work of Sofia Coppola? And because he kind of is, his presence, certainly in On the Rocks, you know, that's it's very consciously a version of a father. He drives the same car that her father had when he was a young man. So there are kind of very tight connections. I love that the story of the wedding when she married Spike Jonze. They had the wedding at the Napa Valley Vineyards. And, you know, it's a bit like the opening of The Godfather. All the family are there.
Yeah.
But there are these kind of generations of filmmakers. So there's kind of David O. Russell and Wes Anderson, you know, milling around with George Lucas and Coppola and all that kind of that breed. What a mix of, you know, what were the conversations they had over kind of, you know, wedding cake and wine? And they kind of, you know, what are you guys doing? What camera do you use? You know, no, we never do that. Never do that. You know, it's kind of a wonderful. And I think with Wes Anderson, especially, because Wes Anderson is a real, you know, real homage kind of guy. And
yes,
he pays such homage to the movie brat generation in his work. Obviously, in Rushmore, you see the version of Apocalypse Now that, that Schwarzman's character does on stage, the Vietnam film.
And there's a great reference to The Godfather as well, when Max Fisher's getting kicked out of like Rushmore. He says to like the dean, like, "Oh, can you not let me coast by this time? Can you not let me off the hook?" Which I think is like a paraphrase of a line that someone says to Hagen in like Godfather, just before he's about to get whacked. And like, I love like that idea of Wes Anderson and Owen Wilson kind of like rubbing their hands together, going like, "Oh, we've got a Coppola kid in this, and we're going to make some cheeky references to his uncle's films."
Well, it's kind of, it goes, it's such an entangled world that you start to realize. It's like, I don't know if you've been watching Fargo, the television series, but season 5 of Fargo has Jason Schwartzman as the head of a mafia family with an overbearing brother, and it's all crumbling around him. And it's such a play within the world of Fargo on The Godfather. You know, they've even taken shots from The Godfather that they're parodying within it. Okay. And it's Jason Schwartzman doing it, doing a version of Francis. It's fantastic. And that then connects you back to the Coen brothers, you know, and their kind of view on things and their play on things.
Well,
the way they did Miller's Crossing is a pastiche of gangster mythology.
And obviously you've written a book about the Coens, and obviously there's that connection to Nicolas Cage and Ridley Scott. Again, Nicolas Cage, which a film that I think is like, I find it interesting with Nicolas Cage, with the directors he's worked with, because he's kind of like checked off some of like, I guess what a lot of people would argue like Hollywood's biggest directors, whether it is his own uncle or Brian De Palma, Scorsese, but a lot of the time it feels like he has worked in their in-between films to a lot of people. I guess like Matchstick Men, a lot of people would like, do you know what I mean, kind of skip over that one as like, that is like the one for me kind of film, as opposed to the like the studio film by Ridley Scott, stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't think Ridley would see it that way.
Yeah.
I think he's very, you know, proud and I think interested in what he did with the Matchstick Men. I think he did it because he really wanted to break and to test himself in an arena that he wasn't confident or necessarily confident in. He'd done all these huge films and he knew the epic and he knew science fiction. But here it was a almost kind of a new wave comedy, drama, crime movie that harkened to a little bit like what was going on in the early 90s with Tarantino and, you know, that kind of force that had come into Hollywood, you know, and obviously Tarantino, who I've written about, dated Sofia Coppola for a little while. So there's that little entanglement. And I think where Matchstick Men came in, he just wanted to do something a bit European. Although it's set in America, there's sort of bits of Jacques Tati in the performance Nicolas Cage gives. It's that kind of weird European comedy feel about it. I really like it. I think it's very underrated.
And
actually very moving. I've really kind of, that scene at the end in the carpet shop, I find very touching, that in the end, it was a father-daughter thing that mattered to him. The money didn't matter.
The
con didn't matter. It was the connection. And that's what broke his heart.
Yeah. I go, well, that is the thing. Like, it, obviously for the directors, it's not a case of it is like an in-between film for them, but I think it's like the public perception a lot of the time, because I guess like Bringing Out the Dead is like, for me, like a really like when people talk about that amazing run of Nicolas Cage in the 90s. It's one that kind of gets skipped over, and it's like, it's fantastic. It's like this kind of like, it's Scorsese and Schrader really getting back to that kind of dark underbelly of New York, but told through this weird story of a guy who's like a paramedic and stuff like that. Like,
it's actually a terrific film. I actually saw it in New York, which is a great place to watch a Scorsese film. If you can, try and see a Scorsese film in New York. When you come out, you're like, oh my God, I'm here. It's a fantastic feeling. I love that film. I think it's one of Scorsese's best. And it is, as you say, it's a companion to Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
In the sense of the lost soul on the streets and seeing the ghosts of the people he couldn't save. I mean, he's a different character to Travis Bickle, but he's incredibly intense. And it's Cage's, yeah, I think these days we get caught up a little bit in the kind of Cage's quirkiness and what kind of crazy thing is he going to do next? And how crazy is the film going to be around him? And we forget how subtle he can be and how moving he can be and how he can be absorbed into the film around him. If you watch Bringing Out the Dead, there's no doubting it's a Martin Scorsese film and incredibly intense. And it's not like Cage comes in and turns it into the Cage Show. He doesn't at all. He absolutely fits in with the world that movie creates. And yeah, I think it, for him and for Scorsese, it's one of their best films.
To kind of bring it back to like the wider Coppola family is like, you look at Adaptation, a film that like kind of arguably wouldn't have happened without that Sophia and Spike Jonze connection. It kind of very much again felt like that thing of like, Sophia, do you think your cousin like might star in my film? And I always love that story of how, and it's something I always joke about, is like, there is no Spike Jonze as we know him without Francis Ford Coppola passing on the script for being John Malkovich, right?
Oh yeah. You know, again, you have to say, how much has Coppola, you know, shaped the movie universe around him? Yeah, he got the script to Malkovich. Yeah, you know, he made that happen. He can't do that film without Malkovich. It's just impossible. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And he got it as well. I think what's brilliant about that story is that Coppola, you know, understood what Spike Jonze was trying to do. He understood this kind of sort of perverse humor and this sort of postmodern way of approaching film. And Coppola got it. Yeah, he was excited by it. And yeah, he has done a lot behind the scenes that I think we don't really sort of credit him for. You know, he was on the board at MGM at one point. You know, it wasn't particularly successful at that point, but he was around influencing, you know, what was going on there. So he's had this incredible career, sense of, yes, we always talk about the kind of the classics, as it were, and we think of those, understandably, but actually it's many storied his life. And you know, once I started chipping away at the wine, you know, the vineyards, that's extraordinary what they were doing out there, because it wasn't a working business. It was a poor vineyard, but they bought it and they turned it around, and suddenly it started really making money. It started making more money than the films. And he became this kind of vintner. He became this kind of man of Napa Valley who was growing these incredible grapes and launching all this kind of wine on the world. Family business, you know. And then he put the sort of filmmaking into the lap of that. He had his offices there and they had screening rooms there. And, you know, the family would come. And you'd all these wonderful stories about, you know, as they prepared any film, you'd bring the cast up to Napa Valley to do the rehearsals there. Yeah. And in the evening, they would drink wine and he would cook them dinner and they would just talk about the world. And this was the way of sort of creating the family of the film before they started.
Yeah, I love those the DVD extra. I think it's on a Miramax release, like a two-disc edition of One from the Heart. And there's all this footage of Tom Waits at the Napa Valley house, kind of like talking about like how Francis wanted the songs and stuff like that. And it like really warms your heart. And you hear these stories of Francis like cooking like a big like bolognese for everyone, like on set and stuff like that. And it's like, it's, I don't know, you can throw away all those ideas of like nepotism and this guy who cares about money. Cause when you kind of like peel off the layers of it, he clearly doesn't care about money, cause he's made so many gambles. To the fact of like, he could have taken the easy route and he's gone, fuck it, I won't. Like, do you know what I mean? I'll finance it myself and I'll spend however long in up in the Philippines trying to make Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, you know, I think you're actually right. He doesn't care about the money at all. He spends it so easily. He doesn't control it. I mean, it's what drove Lucas mad. It's like, why don't you care about the money, Francis? You've got to put some away. I mean, he loved luxury. Don't get me wrong. He loved big houses and swimming pools and parties and living the life, buying art. And you know, he was extravagant. That's all part of his personality. But absolutely, he wanted to spend the money to gain control. Mm-hmm. Screen ownership of the films, to be the kind of the mogul figure who's driving, you know, the creativity. The problem with that was always along that he couldn't be both things. He couldn't be the kind of vibrant, difficult artist, the kind of, you know, the Michelangelo and be the Pope Julius at the same time. He couldn't be the two figures. And so with One from the Heart, you know, his great nightmare was the guy who owned the studio had to deal with the director who was making the film, and they were the same person. And it all got muddled. It's like, so he forgot about being a mogul and was a runaway director, but his boss was himself. And this was kind of what was going wrong.
Yeah, I've recently found out a fact, like an intern or like a runner at Zoetrope Studios was David Fincher, and I always love that kind of like there's a seed that like there's no, do you know what I mean? Again, there's no Fincher without Coppola. It all kind of like as the more I kind of dig, and like even though I feel like I'm a pastiche of myself, because obviously I've gone into a podcast going, the Coppolas are the greatest film family of all time. Let me prove it to you. Like, as much as I'm like, I'm saying that tongue in cheek, I keep looking back to it. I'm like, oh, there is a lot of connections to say that they've done. Do you know what I mean? They've like,
yeah,
they're kind of proving it. So, is there any latter day Coppola films that you do enjoy? Is there kind of stuff that you would recommend people check out? Because I know it kind of gets lambasted a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think there is. I think you have to sort of qualify a little bit when you talk about sort of second phase Coppola, so post Rainmaker Coppola, after he had a sort of nearly a 10-year hiatus where he didn't make anything and then came back with Youth Without Youth, Tetro, and Twixt. Twixt, I would leave. It was designed to be a sort of experiment with live editing, and that didn't work out. And there's some great visuals in it. Yeah, it looks a bit like Sin City in a way. He's sort of dallying with computers. But as a horror movie, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's kind of an oddball thing. But I think both Youth Without Youth and Tetro have a lot in them that's worth seeking out. Youth Without Youth is very strange. And it's based on this sort of Eastern European novella, and it was all shot in Romania. It has a lovely look to it. So it looks a bit like The Godfather, has that kind of rather sepia tone, but it's all about sort of resurrection and a man living forever. And you know, it's a weird story, but has a certain kind of eloquence about it and wonderful sort of moments. But I think Tetro is the one. Again, it has strangeness in it, dream stuff, but it's family, it's brothers, and it's also in Buenos Aires, but it's the family, it's a Coppola family story replayed, you know, within the textures of this kind of new family, which the younger brother sort of looks up to this kind of difficult older brother, and complications arise with a play that he'd written once. So it's about the artistic process and the marriage of that with family. I think it's a great movie.
So one of the things I noticed in the book is you touch upon, like, not just obviously Sophia and Francis's films, but in the later chapters you look at like Roman's films and even like Robert Schwartzman or Gia Coppola's films. Were there any like films that really like jumped out to you of like, oh wow, like these guys don't really get talked about, like apart from like maybe in passing of they happen to be related to the Coppola family?
Definitely. Gia is fascinating. She's sort of a mix of Francis and Sophia in a way. She's the granddaughter, if you're unaware of that. She is Gio's daughter, and he was killed before she ever got to meet him. So there's a strange legacy with Gia, and she grew up in the embrace of the family, and herself was a young child on the sets of her aunt's films. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting legacy being handed down. So it was natural she too would become a filmmaker. Palavista, isn't it?
Palo Alto.
It's an intriguing film. It's flawed, but it's an intriguing drama about teens that often gets lumped in with it's a kind of a Sophia film, but I don't think it is. It's got a kind of darker, stranger, you know, tenser quality to it that Sophia's films have. Robert Schwartzman is interesting. He's almost like an outlier of the whole scenario because he sort of operates a bit more autonomously. He's in a couple of he's a very good looking guy, and he was in a couple of Sophia's early films. He's in Virgin Suicides, another role around. And he's the brother of Jason. And he's been in a band, and the band was very successful. Yeah. And he's it's kind of other life. And he's made three films which are good, actually. You have to sort of track them down a bit. They're not widely distributed and they're very indie. But he makes a kind of quirky social commentary comedies, sort of along the lines of The Graduate a little bit. So again, is his own man, his own sort of style of things. And he's a guy who's also setting up companies, rather like Francis.
Yeah, yeah.
Distribute films and work out new ways of playing the system. So, yeah, I think Sophia and Francis do have, you know, the standout careers in terms of the output, which is not a radical thing to say. But there's really interesting undercurrents beneath that.
Yeah.
Your devotion to Nicolas Coppola is Nicolas Cage, well, Nicolas Coppola is his real name, is really admirable because that's an extraordinary career. And I really would love to, if I had the space and time, to have explored that more in relation to the family. How much is he trying to break away and doing a different thing? How much actually can you see elements of the family in his choices and work?
Yeah, yeah. I always joke about the fact of, like, he broke away by changing the surname, but was happy to, like, kind of take a slice of the family pie when it was like he got a small part in Rumblefish and then got the kind of, like, almost like second lead in Peggy Sue Got Married and stuff like that. But, like, he's fascinating because, and it's been said on this podcast and fantastically said by film producer Daniel Noah of Spectrevision, who worked on Mandy and Color Out of Space, who said that Nicolas Cage is like a garden hose that, depending on whether a director can, like, either let that garden hose run wild in the garden, like, it will just go everywhere, or if they hold it correctly, it can, like, you can water your garden and have beautiful flowers, like, blooming by the spring. Because that is the thing. I think he is, like, a guy who is, like, got these fascinating ideas, and, like, everyone I've spoke to who's ever worked with him has these, like, stories of, no matter what the budget is, he will come on day one going, I know the script back to front, I know everyone else's lines as well, and I've got this list of things I want to do with the character. And in Color Out of Space, his thing was, like, each member of the family has a different, like, reaction to the color, and his is like a thing of smell. So throughout the film, he's like, can you smell that? It smells rancid. He wanted to wear a clothes peg on his nose. And, like, Daniel Noah and Elijah Wood, who were, like, producers on it, were kind of like, and the team who worked on that film were like, hey, Nick, that's probably not a good idea. Do you know what I mean? Like, and the fact that he makes all these films, it feels like he's got that spirit of his uncle in a way, of that kind of, like, let's go for broke. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, and he likes a lavish lifestyle. Do you know what I mean? It's very famously out there that he kind of some squandered money on, like, haunted mansions and pyramids and dinosaur skulls. So, yeah, I think he's very much a part of that of that lineage that his uncle put out there.
Yeah, he is, and you're absolutely right. I think he has that passion. And he has that craziness that certainly Francis, far more because August, Nicholas's father, was he was an academic and a writer on literature, and was very different from Francis. So I think the gene that came down was the one that had gone through Francis and passed on to Nicolas Cage. It was that kind of wildness, artistically especially, that and you look at the performances again with Francis. It's really out there. The beginnings of the kind of the crazy Nicolas Cage are there in the kind of these Coppola films.
Yeah.
A little bit in Rumblefish, but it's definitely there in Cotton Club, where he's doing almost a cartoon version of gangsters. And it's there in the squeaky voice performance of Peggy Sue Got Married, where in his head, it was a cartoon world that had been created. So he was playing a cartoon character with a cartoon voice. So absolutely, I think you can really see the links with, and the frustrations also, because he wanted more work from Francis that he got, I think, that he is a Coppola, and it's there, and he can't escape it, whether he wants to or not.
I'm not sure how much like steam there is in this, but like I vaguely might have been IMDb trivia, so it might be totally bullshit. But that Somewhere is somewhat based on, like, there are elements of the Stephen Dorff character that are borrowed from Nick Cage. Like I think he at one point had a tenure at staying at the Chateau Marmont and stuff like that. And if you kind of look at that character, it's kind of part Francis Ford Coppola and part Nicolas Cage in a way, of a kind of like a guy who was massively successful and has fallen on these like more, down times and stuff like that. And I love that aspect of the family, that they kind of like they draw in all from each other. Like that, I think that Stephen Dorff role could have easily been played by Nicolas Cage. Like maybe if he was like 10 years, I don't know, 5-10 years younger. Yeah. It very much feels like it could have been a Cage performance, like whipping about in a sports car and kind of being this woman.
Tony, because if you think about it and you do it on, you know, the money movies make, the most successful member of the Coppola clan is Nicolas Cage. He's made more money than any of them, including Francis. You know, he's been in, you know, Gone in 60 Seconds and, you know, Con Air and all the kind of the films he's done. You put it all together, and actually he's the most successful one of them. Of course, he's sort of fallen into this new part of his career when he's not making sort of blockbusting films anymore. But it's, you know, he was a big movie star. And I certainly think he's there in Somewhere. I think Johnny Depp's a bit in Somewhere as well. I think that they actually talked about casting Johnny Depp at one point. And it's sort of, Stephen Dorff was another friend of Sophia's, and she wanted the kind of friendship thing to play in, someone who's in her circle. That kind of plays back in. And of course, Sophia had lived in the Chateau Marmont. He's also slightly a version of her in a strange way.
Yeah.
She's both the daughter and the father. She's kind of in both places. But of course, it's Francis as well in the daughter-father relationship.
Yeah, and especially that sequence when they go to Italy, right, for the, like...
Probably all the ice cream and all that.
Yeah. And that kind of, I think she said in interviews, she remembers as a child going to some, like, award ceremony that kind of had this, like, very... pantomime hokey dance, and like him, like Francis kind of loving it but at the same time feeling quite awkward about the whole situation. And like I love that through these films we get like a snapshot into who they are as a family, and like almost in a way, I don't know, as much as Francis rails against like kind of cinematic universes, whether it's Marvel or kind of DC and stuff like that, his family have almost created this cinematic universe of these autobiographical films that are all about them.
Yeah, absolutely. But Francis would sort of say, well, that's what artists should be doing. Yeah. You tell your own story. You don't tell these stories about ridiculous people in tights. I remember I interviewed Francis, you know, a few times, but I interviewed him on shortly after The Dark Knight had come out, and everyone was talking about The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
You know, it was that point in time, and Christopher Nolan. And I asked him if he's seen it. And he goes, yeah, I saw it. I saw it, you know, shake of the head and that kind of was dismissive. It's made all this money and you can't bear the fact this film has made all this money. And he's a very talented guy, clearly a talented director. But it's about a guy in a silly suit. That's what it is. It's for children. And that's how he saw it. And these were guys who grew up, the movie brats, if you want. They were guys who grew up in the 1960s, heavily influenced by, he was heavily influenced by theatre, but they were all heavily influenced by what was going on in Europe and France and you know, the idea of auteurship. And they grew up in political times.
Yeah.
They grew up against an America in turmoil, Vietnam, Nixon, all those things. So it almost became beholden, you know, in terms of who they were as filmmakers, to be serious about what they were going to portray and put into their films. It was a calling. And of course, then they all brought their own baggage and their own style. And with Francis, it's very much about family. And with Martin Scorsese, it was about the streets and New York and where he'd grown up. And with Spielberg, it was about suburbia and divorce and his life. With Brian De Palma, I have no idea. It was all craziness in Brian De Palma's head. Whatever he was going on in Brian De Palma's head, I don't know. But there were all those things that they kind of brought into it. Mm. So I suppose they would look at the current generation and think they're just technocrats. You know, they're just guys who knew the technology and know the talent, but just want to make far-fetched, you know, blockbusting superhero films. You know, and Lucas and Spielberg, yeah, certainly, you know, a lot to blame for this kind of change in Hollywood and flow. But still, even Lucas, I think, made personal films. You know, the Star Wars films, his original three, are quite personal. Mm-hmm. I always think of them as they're kind of like American Graffiti mixed with THX. The style of THX with all the warmth of American Graffiti, like a Venn diagram. In the middle of it, you get Star Wars. You know, that's kind of like that kind of 60s warmth and kind of Americana mixed with the cold austere THX-1138, which is the Empire and the Rebellion. You put them together and you get Star Wars. You know, it's personal. I think that, you know, superhero films are very popular and can be very entertaining. But I have sympathy with their viewpoints. I do, because I can't see Hollywood ever creating Apocalypse Now again.
Yeah.
I can't see it creating The Godfather again. And maybe those historical circumstances were unique. But right now, I think it's going to be hard for Lost in Translation to get made. Mm-hmm. Because it's, yeah, and Sophie is now working on a television show. And so, yeah, they're getting siphoned off because that's where the money is and the opportunity is and the creative freedom is. It's all in streaming and television. So I do think it's a point. You know, I kind of, when I hear these announcements that Marvel are making another 8 films and they're all going to slot in here and they're all interlinked and it's all marvelous. A little bit inside me dies. And I think, but, you know, I would give them all. I'd trade them all in, every single one of them, for 5 minutes of Apocalypse Now. I would. Yeah. I can keep 5 minutes of Apocalypse Now versus all of Marvel, and you can come at me, fans, if you want to come at me. I would do that trade. It's a great film writer called David Thompson. I don't know if you know David Thompson. He's terrific. He's based in San Francisco. He knows Francis Coppola very well. He's written about him very well. He said once he was writing about Blade Runner. He said, I would trade in all three Indiana Jones films, it was three at the time, for half an hour of Blade Runner. So I would do that trade. And I kind of get that.
Yes.
You know, I love the Indiana Jones films. They were very important films and they still are. They fill me with great joy. They're wonderfully made films. So don't get me wrong. I'm not sort of saying they're Marvel films. But I get the half an hour because Blade Runner is so extraordinary and talks to me in so many strange ways that I need to keep Blade Runner, you know, because that's the film lodged in my head in a way that those other films aren't.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that move to TV because obviously, like, I'm not sure if you ever checked out Roman and Jason Schwartzman, like, had a, like, with the director of American Pie, of all things, and about a boy and being Flynn. They co-created this show called Mozart in the Jungle, which was, yes, like, I'd like, it's like one of those things, like, I got really into it last year as I started, like, deep diving into this, and then it's like 3 or 4 seasons and then got cancelled or whatever. But, like, it's interesting. And I think, like, Roman, again, is another, like, because I recently spoke to Sky Elobar, who starred in The Greasy Strangler, but, like, he reached out to me and was like, hey, like, I actually starred in 4 commercials that were directed by Roman Coppola. And I think, like, he's this kind of, I don't know, he's like the silent but deadly member of the family, I think. He's kind of, like, ticking underneath, like, I think he, like, owns, like, a company. He's basically, like, the CEO now of Zoetrope and stuff like that, isn't he?
He runs Zoetrope now, and Francis has sort of handed it all on now. And really, apart from his own films that get produced under Zoetrope, doesn't have much to do with the day-to-day operations. I'm sure he looks in occasionally,
has
a coffee from the fine espresso machine and sort of dawdles around the desks occasionally looking at some screenplays. But in practical terms, he sort of retired from Zoetrope. And it's fallen to Roman. And Roman was an interesting character because he isn't a natural director. And I don't mean to say that he can't direct because, you know, he's made two films and they're kind of quirky and very interesting, CQ especially. And he's a great second unit. He's been second unit on all of Sophia's films and obviously worked on a lot of Francis' films. Had the kind of almost galling job of stepping in where after Gio died, because Gio basically became the apprentice to his father. He mm-hmm. worked beside his father, dropped out of school, worked beside his father in all his films. He was being trained up to be a director, Gio, and then obviously tragically was killed during the making of Gardens of Stone, yeah. It was a boating accident. And it was Roman who had to step into that gap and become, you know, sit beside his father in the edit suites and be the technical guy for his father. And I think he's been a facilitator. I think he has more of his mother in him, maybe, mm-hmm. than his father. You know, he's a facilitator and he's a gentleman kind of guy. He is an absolute backbone to Sophia. I think he's helped her write screenplays. He's a very good writer, Roman. Yeah. You know, you said about Wes Anderson's work. Roman's hugely important in that. And runs the company and finds new ways for the company to operate. He's also someone who's interested in streaming and future, keeps all that buoyant. So he has that kind of calm, collected kind of George Lucas-y side to him, mm-hmm. that says, keep the money safe. Let's not go running off doing anything crazy. And so it's been very important for the family, very important to keeping that going, but hasn't been the auteur, maybe, that yeah. Sophia has become. She's got more of her father in him, although she's calm as well, than Roman has. I mean, I suppose we hang out in the family, we went for dinner, we looked at them all, and we'd probably see Roman is very like his father in many, yeah, many ways.
He looks a spitting image, right? He's like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and he loves going to Cannes, and he loves all that kind of side of it. So yeah, absolutely. But I think it's interesting that he didn't become the director. That was maybe that path, you know, was something he just hadn't naturally wanted.
Yeah, and even his writing, it draws back to the family, because in Moonrise Kingdom, there's the moment when Bill Murray and Frances McDormand are like talking to each other via like loudspeakers. Do you know what I mean? They've got like the bullhorns, yeah. like shouting to each other. And that is lifted from Roman's childhood. He's like, that's how like my parents would communicate around the house. And I guess it's that kind of like hangover from film sets. Yeah, yeah. And they're like, well, that works on a film set. Do you know what I mean? We've got this massive Napa Valley mansion. Like let's kind of round up the kids by like shouting through a bullhorn, like, Roman, get down for dinner. Like we've got pasta.
Well, yeah, it's the divide between family life and movie making life is indistinct. There isn't really a divide between, as we were saying right at the beginning. So the kids grew up on movie sets. Yes. I mean, The Godfather, the baby is Sophia. You know, she was born during the production of that film. You know, there was Marlon Brando blessed her on the set. You know, that's all there. So they grew up with it. So actually, the dividing line isn't there. I mean, one of the fabulous stories, I think, of Apocalypse Now is just following Sophia during that time. And she was 4 years old. I think she became five because it went on so long. And she was at school. I mean, the two boys went back to America to go to school and came back out to the Philippines, to Manila. But Sophia was there the whole time, learned to speak the local language, and so went to the local school. And that idea of the family was so present. And there's a wonderful story, it's a really strange story of, and I put it in the book, so it was a poignant image in the end. She got knits, any school kid these days who goes to school gets knits, but obviously in the Philippines it was very common. And there's a moment then during the hellstorm of Apocalypse Now, when this guy's brain is about to burst, where Eleanor says it, he was sitting calmly picking the knits out of Sophia's hair, and he was calming to the moment. He had a job to do with his child. He had a torch. He was trying to find them. And actually this brought serenity to him, in the midst of the storm of this film that he couldn't figure out and the making of it and all those things. He was being a father, and the father made sense to him and brought him back to himself. Mm-hmm. And I think having the children around was a great force in his life, mm-hmm. because they always brought him back to himself, the presence, the family table, the meals, and having them and seeing the kids. And during the pandemic, they all came back to live on the vineyard.
Yeah, yeah.
All 23 people, 23 relatives, grandchildren. Running around, and he loved it. I think that's what he wanted during this terrible time. He wanted the family back around him. And it's probably almost like a movie set, I imagine, yeah, with bullhorns, I'm sure. Everybody in for dinner, you know, giant bowls of pasta and movie club at night and all these things. It's all, that is so him.
I hope with the grandkids he did what he did with his children, which is a favourite story of mine, is when they were young, he would do like writing workshops and they would kind of put on plays. And like, I think it's Jason Schwartzman, which I very, very much like, shows you why he was perfect to play someone like Max Fisher, is like, however young he was, maybe like 10 years old, kind of wrote this one act play based on like Tennessee Williams or something like that. And then they would like, they would put it on in the theater. They'd have 2 days to work on it. And then Francis would be like, that's it. We'll stage a play like for the family and stuff like that. Yeah, I hope that happened during the pandemic with the grandkids.
There's a lovely another story that with the grandchildren, when they hit the age of 9, which is when he got polio, was bedridden, he takes each of them individually anywhere in the world they want to go. Wow. He sits down with his grandchild, each one, and says, 9 years old, okay, where do you want to go in the world? And he takes them. And this is about his own childhood, being unable to move, being trapped in one room for a year. And it's a kind of a gift he's sort of giving back. He's saying, you as my grandchild can go anywhere in the world. And that's where he's got to. And in fact, that's, he's kind of giving away trade secrets of the book, but that's kind of where the book finishes. So it starts with the polio and finishes with this idea that he takes his grandchildren. That's the arc. Amazing. That's sort of a great place to have got to in your life. Through all this turmoil and chaos, he's ended up this place where he's almost Father Christmas. He says, right, I'm sure they all go Disney World. Probably every time. Not Disney World again.
Yeah.
Anywhere else. Not Disney World. I don't know. I don't know where they went, but it's a lovely story that that's what he does for each of them.
I love that. Well, that feels like a perfect place to maybe leave the conversation as well. Kind of come, almost like full circle on it from the beginnings of the book to kind of maybe a spoiler end. For the end. so what comes next for you? Are you working on anything at the moment? Like,
I have just finished a book on James Cameron.
Wow.
Which is a very different story and a very different fish. Very exciting to write about. In fact, I started that before Coppola and the Coppolas. They both were kind of running concurrently, but we were going to do them in that order. But the pandemic altered film schedules and things, and you sort of publish into sort of publicity moments. So we thought we'd wait with Cameron until Avatar 2 was about to land. That I just delivered it, but it comes out this time next year. It's how glacially slow books move. And so it was great. And he's a fascinating story. In some ways, you know, he's kind of an auteur, although he's very, very different, but he's very personally driven. And, you know, almost maniacally at times. But and each of his films is just an astonishing story in its own right. You know, what kind of chaos and genius that went into them.
Well, when you start looking at like James Cameron, like, what is it like, making like foam that can put out fire underwater, and like these expeditions that he kind of self-funded to kind of explore the depths of the ocean and stuff like that. He's kind of like, I don't know, as much as people laugh at him, he's another one who is trying to push what cinema can do and what it's about forward, which like, again, it always feels like a perfect next book after Coppola, right? Because it is that kind of like somebody who probably would have looked at that as somebody who like was the first person over, do you know what I mean? Over the top into be like, right, fuck it. Let's make auteur cinema that's for adult, same time like commercially viable. And that's kind of what James Cameron did with like Terminator and Aliens and stuff like that.
Totally. And I sort of said it in the book, he's like, every time he makes a film, he kind of puts the whole industry on his shoulders and sort of lifts them up like Atlas.
Yeah,
just staggers into the future with the whole industry. That's what James Cameron does. And the difference between him and Coppola is that Cameron has P.T. Barnum in him. He has a kind of a genetic P.T. Barnum nature. So he is a showman. And Coppola's a showman, but he's an artist. Coppola wants to write these autobiographical stories that are very personal about families, even if it's the gangsters or they're in Vietnam. Whereas Cameron has this kind of P.T. Barnum-like, let's put on a show. You know, I'll show you well, film about Titanic, I'm going to show you the whole ship sinking in real time and tip it up like this. And, you know, I'm going to show you. I'm going to have Arnie as this kind of killing machine. And that's kind of a different spirit, but absolutely right. It's kind of equally, he isn't programmed like, you know, I'm going to do a Marvel film. He isn't programmed like a blockbuster maker. He's a guy who shifts the paradigm every time. He kind of gets it and goes. And what he's going to, what I kind of concluded with Avatar 2, 3, 4, however many they're going to be, what he's got to do is reinvent CGI, because CGI has become monotonous and boring and the same in every film. No longer special. It's kind of, it's robotic, and he's got to come and he's got to reinvent it. That's the challenge for him, really. And I'm sure he knows that. So he's going to do things that make the first Avatar look like the Stone Age, and it'll be like beam straight into our heads. Well, like we're in Pandora running around. It'll be some crazy. But yeah, it's been a fascinating ride, just to sort of, and you know, you're borne along by him, like Francis, you're borne along by these stories. So you can get it all in. I've got to get it all in.
Perfect. Well, I very much look forward to checking that one out when it comes out, Ian. Well, thank you so much for coming along and talking about this fantastic, weird and wonderful family that is the Coppolas.
Great pleasure. As I say, it's been in my head for the last 2 years, at least, probably longer. So it's great to have got the book out, and it's great to be able to get it out of my head and talk to people about it as well. Thank you for your interest.
No worries. Well, yeah. Well, where can people like keep up to date with you and like the kind of things you write and the opinions you may have on certain
things? I'm on Twitter, Ian at IanNathan2. Actually, I've got a screen right here glowing on me. This is me attempting to figure out what Substack does, because I want to set up a kind of a blogging kind of system on Substack, which I hopefully get up and running in the next couple of weeks. It's me trying new technology out. I'm a bit of a Luddite, but you know, keeping up with things. Obviously, you know, the books are available in the usual places. Good bookstores, go to your independent bookstore if you can. If not, obviously the evil overlord Amazon stocks them in their many warehouses. And yeah, you know, it's I'm around about. If you're ever at screenings, just shout out and I'm around. I'm there.
Perfect. Again, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you, Ian.
Cheers. Well, have a good evening, and let's speak again soon.
A massive thank you once again to Ian for coming and chatting to me about his fantastic book. And another little reminder to you guys as well to pick up a copy. I'll be sure to drop a little link in the show notes to show you where you could buy it. But if you can, remember, buy a nice local bookshop instead of that bald evil man who's shooting himself into space and feeling like he can get into the public's favor by shooting William Shatner into space as well. We got no time for you, Jeff boy. So as for next week on the podcast, I will be joined by writer, comedian and podcaster Molly McGuinness to talk about the 1994 hostage comedy Airheads, starring Adam Sandler, Steve Buscemi and the great Brendan Fraser, which was lensed by our boy John Swartzman, making it our Coppola connection. It was a really fun chat. I recorded it just earlier this afternoon, the time I'm recording this, giving you a little insight into how the podcast works. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. So be sure to check out that one next week. If you would like to get in touch with the podcast, I always love it if you do. It's fun to engage, have a chat, have a chit and a chat about all things Nicolas Cage, all things Coppola, all things film in general. It's kind of been a weird one for me at the moment. It seems like Twitter is awash with James Bond and Dune chat. And something about them, I'm just not interested. So I'm kind of taking a back seat at the moment, trying to be like,
I don't want to just have an opinion for the sake of it, because I'm just not interested. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd, all at Caged In Pod. Or if you would like to, I don't know, have a little bit more of a deeper conversation, or you've got a lot more to say to me, or there's something you want to say that you don't want on a social platform, that's cool. DM me or send me an email at cagedinpod@gmail.com. If you're listening to this thinking, you know what, I would really love to support Petros and everything he's doing with this podcast, you can sign up to Patreon, which is patreon.com/cagedinpod, where soon there will be a new bonus season of the podcast just for Patreons called The Movie Brat Bros, and season one will be De Palmarama, where I'll be looking at the films of Brian De Palma and seeing how they work in relation to the career of Francis Ford Coppola, e.g. in 1974, did Brian De Palma do a better film than The Godfather? You're gonna have to listen to the podcast to find out. So yeah, I'm still ironing out the details on how much that tier is gonna cost, but it's not gonna be much, guys. £4, if that, $4, who knows? It's gonna be cheap. That's gonna be hopefully fortnightly. Obviously, whatever I decide, the price will determine that. Whoever decides to the schedule, the price would be determined by all of that. If you just want to buy me a coffee as well, you can go over to ko-fi.com/cagedinpod, where you can just buy me a little cup of coffee. All the money that goes into there goes into making more fun stuff for the podcast, whether that is merch, whether that is just helping me, if there's equipment that's feeling a bit ropey and needs to replace it, I'll get it all with your help. Or if you don't want to give me your money, that is absolutely fine. If you enjoyed this and still want to support the podcast, you can rate, review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this right now. Or as I mentioned, the socials, you can give me a retweet, you can give it a share, you can tell people about this goddamn podcast. Just tell them. Tell your mum, your dad, your brother, your sister, your enemies, your friends, whoever. I don't care. Just get them on board the Caged In train. So as always, guys, I have been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. So remember to keep it caged in, and I will catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.